Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. Today we're discussing Trump's war on the press and the media's role in these perilous times. Trump's second term has been marked by lawsuits against news organizations, sexist and racist attacks on journalists, and xenophobic policies. We are joined by three great guests for the hour. Dan Frumkin is a longtime journalist and media critic. He's editor of Press Watch, an independent nonprofit devoted to encouraging journalists to fulfill their essential mission of creating an informed electorate and holding the powerful accountable. Dan Frumkin spent nearly three decades editing and contributing to HuffPost, The Intercept, and the Nieman Foundation's Watchdog Project. He spent over 12 years at the Washington Post as editor and writer of its White House Watch column, and he's taught journalism at New York University and American University. Dan Frumkin argues that white supremacy is now a core animating principle for the Republicans who control all three branches of government. Hi, Dan. Thanks so much for joining us again. We're also joined today by Will Bunch, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and national opinion columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Will Bunch has written several books on politics, including his most recent, After the Ivory Tower Falls, How College Broke the American Dream and Blew Up Our Politics and How to Fix It. In one of Will Bunch's latest columns, The Trump Regime Murders That Are Not on Videos, he writes, "It's great that the media and Congress are going all Watergate on one of Trump's crimes, the murder of two Caribbean sailors. But the reality is that Trump's death cult has killed hundreds of thousands, mostly through senseless USAID cuts." Hi, Will. Thank you so much for joining us again.
Yeah. Hey, Rose. Thanks for having me back. I appreciate it.
Great to have you back. And Kathy Roberts Ford is professor of journalism at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. Her work focuses on democracy and the public sphere, the Black freedom struggle and the press, and the First Amendment. Professor Ford is Associate Dean of Equity and Inclusion in the College of Social and Behavioral Sciences. She's co-editor with Sid Beginfield of the award-winning book, Journalism and Jim Crow, White Supremacy and the Black Struggle for a New America. The book documents the active role white newspaper publishers and editors played in building and sustaining violent white supremacist political economies and social orders across the South from 1875 to 1920. It also focuses on the incredible role of the Black press during that time. In a recent Time magazine piece, Professor Ford writes, "If we are ever to achieve the inclusive and just democracy of our country's highest aspirations, we need a press willing to stand up for that democracy." Hi, Kathy. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, it's great to have you. It is great to have all of you. Why don't we start on a positive note and talk about a piece of good journalism that you've seen recently, maybe something that has stayed with you. Will, let's start off with you. What did you see recently that stood out for you?
Yeah. One of my favorite writers is the independent journalist now, Hamilton Nolan. And he and I, I'm so sorry we didn't cross paths. We were both in New Orleans last week, but he just published an excellent piece on his independent site about the Border Patrol operation down in New Orleans, and a story that I think needs so much more coverage, which is just the way that everyday folks are resisting these ICE raids. People who are forming chat groups and chasing these officers around and giving out their locations, and when they're in a neighborhood, they go there with whistles and cameras and try and alert residents and make sure that their Latino neighbors know to stay indoors. And it's really I think the most remarkable and the most hopeful story at the end of 2025 that we've got going.
You also wrote about this, Will, in one of your latest columns.
Yes, I did. I wrote a couple columns about my trip down there, because I really wanted to highlight this, because, you know, at the beginning of the year, people were saying, well, where is the resistance to Trump? And now we're seeing it, and it's much more powerful than I even imagined. And it's really something to go to these training sessions, meet some of these people, and describe what's happening firsthand. And every city that this Greg Bovino and his Border Patrol squad has been to, you've seen this kind of public backlash and public uprising. It's really quite remarkable.
So you're highlighting the work of independent journalist Hamilton Nolan, who has a Substack. I'd love to talk to all of you about this later, because so many journalists are going independent and writing these incredible newsletters. But the question is, there's so much out there now. And so I'd love to hear you all talk about that. He's got another piece that I'd love to read later, How to Win Red States with a Labor Party. So thank you for that one, Will. And Dan, we're going to talk with you later about this, but you actually started a new newsletter called Heads Up, and you are talking about the most consequential acts of resistance happening under Trump, because it's getting really too little attention right now in the national media. But before we talk about that, Dan, what piece stood out for you this week or even in the last couple weeks?
Well, I would be very happy to give a very loud shout out to Minnesota Public Radio, which has been doing a spectacular job, along with quite a few other really terrific Minnesota local publications, of covering the extent of the resistance to the invasion of federal agents into Minneapolis. With audio, text, and video, they've just done a marvelous job of showing ordinary people showing up and blocking ICE agents from arresting people. Blocking their cars, all sorts of stuff. It's really been quite moving. And I did cover that for my newsletter, Heads Up News. It's great to call attention to these ordinary acts of resistance that local news sites are covering really well.
You're reminding me of what I saw in Chicago with people who had whistles. And they were blowing the whistles anytime they saw an unmarked van or saw ICE agents. And then in, you know, upper class neighborhoods, people were coming out if they saw a van and yelling at agents, saying, you know, you're not welcome here. Dan, given that this is happening now on a regular basis, are you seeing more of this in the major media outlets, more coverage of this?
I'm seeing some. Every so often you'll see sort of an overview piece in a major outlet. And I think that's great. I'm delighted about that. But I don't think they've captured the extent of how this has filtered down to just ordinary folks doing it all day long, all week long. I think that's becoming background noise for the media. And I think it's a shame, because I think it's a really major movement. In general, I don't think the resistance to Trump gets nearly enough coverage. Consider the fact that, you know, his approval rating is now, I mean, the American public is 2-1 against him right now. But you hear really as many voices or more who are supporting Trump than you do who are opposing him.
And we'll talk about that later in the show. So kudos to Minnesota Public Radio and just all of the public radio stations doing such good work out there at a time when the Corporation for Public Broadcasting has lost all of its funding. All of the stations lost their funding starting in October, including KALW and the other stations that carry our show. So thanks for that one, Dan. What about you, Kathy? What stood out for you in the last couple weeks?
Well, I have been following closely student journalist coverage of all manner of really important public issues, including the attacks on higher education that are part of the Trump administration and many state administrations' authoritarian playbooks, right? Attacking the press and attacking higher ed are two of these ways of trying to take down kind of the pillars of democracy. And our student journalists at the Harvard Crimson, for example, at Harvard, the student newspaper at Stanford, our own student newspaper at University of Massachusetts, everywhere, the student journalists are really have moved into the breach and have just been doing really wonderful coverage of their universities during this moment of and in the past couple of years with the campus turmoil. Will just himself here with us just recently wrote about his own take on how impressive student journalists have been recently. So a major shout out to our independent student newspapers all over this country for the work they're doing.
I love that, Kathy. In fact, next month, because this year has been so hard for so many of us, and speaking from experience, we all need to take a deep breath and breathe. It's been just dark news on a regular basis. We're going to focus on more positive stories throughout the month. And thank you. You just gave us a great idea to have some of these student journalists on our media roundtable. Given that you're a professor of journalism at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, what are you hearing from young people who want to get into journalism? What are you hearing from people who work on the school's paper or at the school's radio station? What do they think about media today?
Well, our students are deeply committed. I mean, they have no illusions that it's an easy job. I mean, the market is really, as we all know, constricted. The business model has collapsed. But, you know, this moment of a democratic erosion and rise of authoritarianism in the country, it's motivating for a lot of students. And so many of our students are deeply, deeply committed to the collective good, to the public good. And that has to do with democratic governance, but it also has to do with climate change and all manner of, you know, injustices that they see in the world that they would like to report on, and that they view journalism as a way to inform people and help people have a sense of agency in their lives and to see things clearly. So our students, what I hear from my students is this, you know, very clear-eyed understanding that they're not going to become well-to-do through the practice of journalism, but they will have meaningful lives.
Wow, that is great. Thank you for bringing this one up. I have to say, we have not done enough shows about what is happening on college campuses and student journalists and the incredible work that they're doing. And Will, Kathy gave a shout out to your great column, College Journalism Exposes the Rot of Grownups. Can you tell us and remind us about the role that college journalists played in really staying on the story about Larry Summers and his connection to Jeffrey Epstein? Today, we're joined by three incredible guests for our media roundtable. Will Bunch is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and national opinion columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Kathy Roberts Ford is professor of journalism at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, associate dean of equity and inclusion in the College of Social and Behavioral Sciences, and co-editor of the award-winning book Journalism and Jim Crow, White Supremacy and the Black Struggle for a New America. Dan Frumkin is editor of Press Watch, an independent nonprofit that encourages journalists to fulfill their essential mission of creating an informed electorate and holding the powerful accountable. Dan spent nearly 12 years at the Washington Post as editor and writer of the White House Watch column. And if you would like to join us, if you have any questions for our guest today, if you'd like to talk about media coverage under the second Trump term, if you would like to highlight a piece of journalism that you saw in the last few weeks that you think we should know about, because there's so much great work going on out there, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Dan, I wonder what your thoughts are about how you think we should talk about media in this time. I was just reading a piece from Nieman Lab from June, and there's a new YouGov survey out there that found for the very first time, most Americans are now getting their news from social media and video networks. That has overtaken TV and news websites and apps for the first time ever. And then it was interesting when Will gave Hamilton Nolan kudos, it just made me think about all the journalists that are going to Substack. And then you think about the incredible outlets like ProPublica, The 19th, Mother Jones. There's just so many people doing good work, but there's more info out there than ever. And it's sometimes hard for the good stuff to rise above. So how are you thinking about the state of media today?
Well, I think you make an excellent point. I mean, there is an enormous amount of terrific media out there, but I should point out that there is an enormous amount of deceptive media out there too. For one thing, you know, social media does not do a very good job of distinguishing between what is true and what is not true. And maybe even more to the point, you have the Fox News and its ilk, One America News and have you, that are literally, propaganda outlets for a party that has does not based on true beliefs anymore. So it's very hard to talk about the media in general. I think, especially when you have all these polls that are saying, oh, people have lost trust in the media. I'm like, well, it depends which part, because some parts they're absolutely right to lose trust in. And I write a lot about, the traditional mainstream media, and even that, I think falls short of calling out the it does at this point in our era, at this point in our time, the depths of the crisis that we're facing. I do love the independent voices. I think that you're right, it's an attention economy right now, and it's very hard to get attention.
Right.
One of the things I do try to do in both my newsletters is call attention to both the excellent journalism and try to encourage the bad journalists to do a better job.
What are your thoughts about what's happened at the Washington Post? We got an email from a listener who said that they used to read the Washington Post on a regular basis, and now they steer clear of the op-ed pages because so many good people have left. And Dan, I didn't know actually that Carol Lennig left the Post to go to
Oh, yeah.
MSNBC. We're going to have her on next Wednesday with Aaron David to talk about their new book, Injustice. I just didn't know she left the Post. That's a
The
big
Post
loss.
has lost almost all of its marquee talent. They still have some wonderful people doing wonderful reporting on the news side, but it's a miserably unhappy newsroom. And the editorial pages are absolutely bonkers now. In fact, I just a few minutes ago published on Press Watch a column about the only good thing in the Post opinions universe right now is they have these wonderful AI summaries of reader comments. And Washington Post readers are absolutely livid about these editorials that, since earlier this year, Bezos basically changed the editorial priorities of the paper. They fired almost everybody who was there, replaced them with these sort of amateurish right-wingers, and been writing just egregiously stupid and badly argued, sometimes pro-Trump editorials. One of them actually, talked about how great it was that he was raising the East Wing of the White House. And the reader comments that I summarized are just fantastic. They are worth reading.
Wow. That's incredible. And Kathy, we often hear people saying, I'm not going to read this paper anymore because of what they're doing. And that makes us, kind of sad because these papers also do incredible work. So, for example, on Monday, we're going to be talking about the plastic pollution crisis. And Jake Spring of the Washington Post has a great investigation, Everywhere Chemicals Are in Our Food, Decades After Scientists Recognize Dangers. What are your thoughts about that? How people will write off a news organization because of either who owns it or because of how maybe the op-ed pages have drastically changed?
Well, I think it's tricky business, right? I mean, people often, when they read certain newspapers, they're looking at it in its entirety. And so when you do have like certain elements or desks in a newspaper that kind of go off in wonky directions, or in the case of the Washington Post editorial pages, in just truly tragic directions, at least for what we might hope from the Washington Post might be something that looks like pro-democracy journalism. It hurts the rest of the news enterprise. So, I mean, I understand why people do it. I understand why people kind of tend to gravitate toward news organizations that kind of have a holistic identity and do not only great investigative reporting, but also have an editorial policy and framework that they find attractive, even if they don't always agree with it. I think it's important that we do consume news across a lot of different spaces and ideological perspectives. That doesn't mean we need to consume that we need to consume fake news, the real fake news, or news that's trucks in constant disinformation or authoritarian enterprise. But I think we do need to make space for all the journalisms that there are.
I think this is such a good point. And I wonder, Will, if there's any data out there before we go to break, if you know this. A friend of mine said she's very concerned because her mom only listens to One America News and she's become really angry. And I recently met someone. We were having a nice chat about USAID. And I mentioned the over 600,000 deaths that you cite in one of your columns. And he said, well, that's not what a doctor on Tucker told me. And every time I brought something up, he would go back to what he heard on Tucker. And he only gets his news from Tucker. So I wonder if there are any research, if there is research out there showing that people are getting their news from just a few sources. That's what scares me.
Yeah, absolutely. There's research showing that. And there's also just some fascinating research on the links of people's sources of information and how it affects their, you know, political perspectives. To me, one of the most striking surveys that existed in 2024, I think it came out in the spring of 2024. So it was while Joe Biden was still the presumed Democratic candidate before he dropped out of the race. But there was a poll showing that there were huge disparities based on your primary source of news on who you were voting for, right? So people who read print newspapers, which we all know is a shrinking and increasingly older group of people, but they were overwhelmingly supporting Joe Biden. Whereas people who admitted that they virtually read no news whatsoever or possibly get news either from social media or, like you said, from one of these conservative sites, were overwhelmingly voting for Trump. So, you know, and I think there's a lot more research that needs to be done, but it clearly, you know, the media and where people get their information or where people get disinformation, unfortunately, is just a huge driver of our politics. And you know, one of the most valid complaints about elite mainstream media, like say the New York Times, for example, is that they often overlook how big a factor this is, you know, in politics, that they pretend that, you know, we all just live in this neutral world of information and people are making logical decisions on policies when, like you said, a lot of times people have no idea about what's going on with the Affordable Care Act or USAID or these important things that have happened. So so it's a huge factor. Yeah.
There was a study last year that came out from the Pew Research Center, and it found that young American adults, especially men, are getting their news from social media influencers, a majority of whom are men and lean to the right. You know, like people like Joe Rogan.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, you've probably seen over the last year since Kamala Harris lost the election, all the conversations about how do we get a Joe Rogan of the left. Well, it doesn't work that way. You know, people, right wing media and you know, more progressive media develop in different ways because you're talking about people with different sets of values that you're appealing to. You know, it's you know, it's not, you know, people on the left are more likely to listen to things like public radio, for example, right? So, they might not listen to a Joe Rogan of the left if there really was one. You know, I think to get out of this mess that democracy's in, it does require a better understanding of the role of where and how people get their information and how that affects their political views, for sure.
Right. Well, we're going to take a quick break, and then coming up, we'll talk about what journalists should be doing right now to meet this moment. Will Bunch is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, national opinion columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Dan Frumkin is editor of Press Watch, an independent nonprofit devoted to encouraging journalists to create an informed electorate and hold the powerful accountable. Kathy Roberts Ford is professor of journalism at the University of Massachusetts Amherst and associate dean of equity and inclusion in the College of Social and Behavioral Sciences. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. I'm Rose Aguilar. We'll be back after this.
Our number is 1-800-525-9917. Our website is kalw.org. Click donate. I'm authorized to announce that we have copies of the book Journalism and Jim Crow, White Supremacy and the Black Struggle for a New America, edited by Kathy Roberts Ford, one of our guests today on the Media Roundtable on Your Call. It's available for a $75 gift to KLW right now. It's also available for a $10 monthly membership to KLW as well. Call us right now at 1-800-525-9917 or kalw.org. Click donate, click on thank you gifts, and you're right there. I'm Kevin Vance here with John Carroll.
Good morning, Kevin. I want to thank a few folks who've made gifts of support to KLW already. This morning, Henry Fuerte from San Francisco, Steve Siegelman and Allison Thomas, both from Berkeley, Carol Johnson from San Francisco, who writes, KALW is my island of sanity.
Thank you. Wow.
We feel privileged, Carol, that you feel that way about us. We hope that we provide you a little island of respite here and there in terms of your sanity. We appreciate that comment. You can make a comment too when you make your gift of support. You can call us at 1-800-525-9917. That's 1-800-525-9917. Or you could go online to kalw.org and click donate. And I just want to remind you that everything that you count on, the worldviews, the trusted local news, the courageous conversations that you're hearing like right now, the engaging and illuminating podcasts and music shows that you hear, all of this on KLW relies on you. This is what makes public media unique and crucial. You are the key to it all, and we need your support. Please call us. Please be as generous as possible. 1-800-525-9917 or online at kalw.org. And thank you.
Back to your call.
This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today, we are joined by three guests, Dan Frumkin, longtime journalist and media critic, editor of Press Watch. He spent over 12 years at The Washington Post. Will Bunch, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, national opinion columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer, and author of After the Ivory Tower Falls, How College Broke the American Dream and Blew Up Our Politics and How to Fix It. Kathy Roberts Ford is professor of journalism at the University of Massachusetts Amherst and co-editor of the award-winning book Journalism and Jim Crow, White Supremacy and the Black Struggle for a New America. Kathy, we'd love to have you back to talk about your book. I wonder how doing the research for this book has shaped the way you think about journalism today. It's just so interesting to read some of the examples you write about in your book, about white publishers and editors using their newspapers to build, nurture, and protect white supremacy across the South in the decades after the Civil War. And at the same time, a vibrant black press fought to disrupt these efforts. And so how does that experience of doing the research for this book shape the way that you think about today's times and the role that journalists should be playing?
I think what it's really helped me see very, very clearly is that the United States does indeed have deep historical experience with authoritarianism. It just happened at the subnational level. Every former Confederate state built authoritarian regimes at the state level. And they did this during Reconstruction and after Reconstruction. And they did it in many instances, with white newspaper editors and publishers as active political strategists, working with their Democratic Party colleagues, working with business elites, planter elites, And other public officials and public figures to come up with campaign strategies that were fueled by political violence, racial terror for the most part, to overthrow duly elected state governments, municipal governments. It happened in Mississippi in 1875. It happened in North Carolina in 1898. There are more examples. But what it's really revealed, I think, and this is a part of our a national story that very few people understand and see is that we have this past experience where the press was an architect of building authoritarianism, but at the state level. And so now what we see is we have some journalism, some news outlets in this country who are active partners, it seems to me in any case, in building authoritarianism. Hmm.
And can you talk about why you think, I mean, it's such a tough one because you have billionaires now owning media, we have massive consolidation, and then we have really great independent media, as we've been talking about. Why do you think so many journalists working for major outlets are still afraid to call this for what it is? Just to state the facts about authoritarianism, about what we're seeing under Trump. Is it access? Is it advertising? What do you think it is?
I think it's access. I think it's advertising. I think it's professional norms, or the way in which they understand professional norms of objectivity and neutrality and disinterestedness as allowing them not to name it or pushing them not to name it. And I think that's a real mistake. I think they're afraid of being called partisans and yet being pro-democracy or tracking and naming the authoritarian threats and organizing it in a frame of encroaching authoritarianism and democratic erosion is actually simply descriptive. It's not partisan. It's not about partisan politics. I mean, there's obviously one party at the moment or a faction of one party at the moment that has been, you know, it's a reactionary right wing that's causing and is the architect of some of this democratic or the great bulk of the democratic erosion. But I think so many journalists, particularly in legacy outlets, just simply their editors don't allow them to do this. And it's a real problem. Hmm. And both Dan and Will have talked about it quite a bit.
Yeah. Dan, what would you like to say as we're ending the year and we've seen so much authoritarian, so many authoritarian policies coming from this administration? What are your thoughts?
I think Kathy's exactly right. It's these institutional norms that are just killing these news organizations right now because they're actually withholding the truth from their readers. You can't cover the daily drip of Donald Trump and what this government is doing without explaining how it's all in the service of these greater themes. The increased authoritarianism is one of them, but of course Trump's personal derangement and debility is another. The fact that Christian nationalism is and racism are endemic to this administration, the misinformation and lies that they use. I mean, I could go on and on. I did go on and on in a column earlier this week. There are just these essential truths about what a terrible crisis we're facing as a country that are not reflected, especially in the daily coverage, and even in the sort of the news analyses that look kind of tough. They're still full of weasel words and they're not calling these things out. And the reason is absolutely, I believe, it comes from the top. It comes from the top editors and from the mid-level editors who are doing what they think the top-level editors want. And that is by, that the sort of the number one goal is to avoid being accused of partisanship. And when the partisan battle lines right now are along the lines of truth, that's a very difficult place to be. There is no center. So these news organizations try to occupy a center and it doesn't exist anymore.
You have two really important columns about this, Dan. One is New York Times editor Joe Kahn misunderstands what the readers write or want. You write, Joe Kahn, the executive editor of the New York Times, says the hardest part of his job is resisting pressure from readers, but he seriously misunderstands what those readers want. He said in a recent Q&A, the most challenging part of the job is producing an independent news report when some readers really want a more partisan one. Our readers have their own beliefs and some want to see more coverage that aligns with their views. That's what Joe Kahn recently said, and you point out, readers are not asking the Times to print propaganda or stump for Democrats. They simply want the Times to be more clear-eyed and honest about the depth of the crisis this country currently faces.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there is a sense in which these editors define success as being criticized by both sides. And you'll see the Times go to great lengths to sort of take pot shots at the left to sort of prove its bona fides. And I find at this point, it's come to the point where it's actually deceptive. They're actually misinforming their readers when they leave out these huge parts of the story.
The other column that's really important, Dan, that you wrote in October, you can't cover Washington accurately and not mention white supremacy. You write, it's becoming increasingly clear that white supremacy is one of the core animating principles of the Republicans who control all three branches of government. And then you writes a few of the headlines that have come out, like the Trump White House is considering an overhaul of the refugee system that would favor white people. And then those leaked messages exposed a racist chat among young GOP leaders. Can you elaborate on this one a bit?
Well, it's gotten so much worse, so much more obvious just in the last few weeks with Trump's just vile racist assault on the Somali people, his proud embrace of having called a bunch of countries. Can I say that? I can't say that. He denied it 5 years ago when he was reported as having said it. Now he's proud of it. He's bragging to a bunch of fans in Pennsylvania about it. The extent to which Stephen Miller is guiding the policies of this country, the new national security report that came out that basically encouraged white populism in Europe and said warned of that Europe was being attacked by immigrants. This is just and of course what we see daily in the streets of our major blue cities, them chasing down and tackling brown people and black people just because of the color of their skin. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is absolutely astonishing. If you told people a year ago this was going to happen, they would have been in complete shock.
And we should mention that Trump gave a speech at the White House Congressional Ball on Thursday and was interrupted by someone who shouted when Trump was talking about Somalians. Mm-hmm. Trump was interrupted by someone saying, "Send them home, send them home."
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and then he said, "Thank
Ilhan
you."
Omar said she. Yeah. Said, well, he called the Somali people garbage, which is absolutely dehumanizing and terrifying language coming from somebody in power. He attacked Ilhan Omar, said she was an American citizen, said she should be sent back to Somalia. The fact that our media organizations are squeamish about using the words racist or white supremacy at a moment when it explains so much of what is happening around us, I find really depressing.
Will, what would you like to add?
Yeah, well, I think Dan's been spot on with these pieces that he's written. And I think there's a bigger picture here, which is, you know, we've heard for the last 8 or 10 years from the top editors at these elite papers like Joe Kahn or even Marty Baron when he was running the Washington Post, he said famously, you know, we're at work, we're not at war. And, this has fallen back on, you know, so often that, you know, that we, you know, that we don't want to be part of the story. And the thing is, journalism and democracy are just so intrinsically linked with each other. Because, you know, when you think about it, I mean, I think we all know you can't have a real democracy without some form of journalism informing people and challenging authority. But it works the other way. You also can't have journalism without a democracy, because otherwise you'll have censorship or some of the other crazy things that are happening right now. And, you know, newspapers, newsrooms, news organizations, TV newsrooms, they do take sides on issues, right? You know, they'll lobby the state legislature for laws about open government or laws about protecting sources or whatnot. Well, nothing is bigger right now than protecting democracy. And I think, you know, I think what Dan's hit on and what I've written about a few times is that the mainstream large outlets don't get it. They don't get that their very existence, as well as the existence of a democracy that affects their readers, is in such peril. You know, one other situation that's going on right now that I'm kind of surprised it hasn't come up, but I'll bring it up briefly, which is the way that Trump has been treating certain journalists at these press conferences. You know, he called actually a journalist who's a good friend of mine. He referred to as Piggy on Air Force One, and his attack on this black female journalist, because those seem to be his favorite targets, are black women journalists, at his recent news conference. And you know, I feel strongly, and I'm hoping to write about this soon, and I'd love to hear from other journalists, you know, probably not the ones at these elite outlets, but if they feel the same way as I do, that they really should treat these situations differently. They really should, in the moment, voice defend their colleague in the moment. You know, a voice outrage at the president. And, you know, I mean, this will probably never happen, but, you know, if Trump doesn't apologize to this journalist, they should really consider walking out, you know. And, you know, and they've been asked this, and they say, like I said, they say that they don't want to become part of the story. Well, it's too late, you know, this whole we're not at war. Well, you are at war, because, you know, a authoritarian government has declared war on you, and they've declared war on the free press. And we need people to fight back. And, you know, it hurts everybody, because when they don't stand up for journalism, it affects all of us down the line, even people here in Philadelphia who aren't part of the DC press corps. You know, we get less respect because they allow themselves to be bullied. And I really hope that going into 2026, that maybe we'll see let me put it this way. I would love to see a new attitude from the people who cover Trump on a daily basis. Mm-hmm. I also strongly doubt that's going to happen, unfortunately. But it would be great. It would be great for journalism and the future of journalism if they stood up for our profession. That's for sure.
You know, a few of us were talking about that this morning. Should journalists stick up for each other at these press conferences when Trump says these horrible things, or does that play into his hands? And is that what he's looking for?
To some degree, but, you know, it's, you know, like I said, it's like a war situation. You know, nobody wants to fight, but when you've been invaded, you have to fight back. And basically I feel that journalism has been invaded at this point. So the options are fight back or lose and lose respect.
Well, since you brought up what you're hoping for in 2026 in our remaining minutes, Dan, what are you hoping for to see more of in the media in 2026? We have about a minute left.
I would like to see at least one major news organization sort of recognize that we're in an authoritarian state, that we're in what they call competitive authoritarianism, and stop debating that. But say, okay, and then start turning coverage to how do we survive it.
Kathy, what about you? What would you like to see next year in the media?
I would love to see a digital startup or a conglomeration of Substack authors kind of put together a democracy desk and like pull together some of the best reporting out there and put it in the frame of democratic erosion and authoritarian consolidation and frame it and track it for the public.
I love this idea, Kathy, because I think people are so overwhelmed and no one is going to go to 12 or 15 websites every day to see what's out there. But it would be great to have one space where you can find all of this incredible journalism, because there's so much going on. I just want to, again, give kudos to Robert Lopez, who's an independent reporter. We had him on earlier this week. He's done incredible work about underage farm workers in California who don't have access to shade or even clean drinking water. They're also exposed to toxic pesticides. I mean, we're talking about kids as young as 11. And as a result of his reporting, California state agencies say they're going to crack down on child labor violations. And we're going to do a follow-up show about this next month. So it would be amazing, Kathy, if there was a place where people could go to find that reporting and then to keep track of who's doing good work. I don't know if that exists right now.
I don't know either. I don't know if Dan or Will know, but it would be certainly great to have it. And we need to encourage this kind of incredible reporting that Robert Lopez is doing, because it changes public policy and orients public policy toward the public good, which is what, you know, the best journalism in our country has always done.
Yeah, I love that idea. Well, thank you all so much for the great work that you're doing, and we'd love to have you back in the new year. Kathy Roberts Ford is professor of journalism at the University of Massachusetts Amherst and co-editor of the book Journalism and Jim Crow, White Supremacy and the Black Struggle for a New America. And Kathy, we would love to have you back to talk about your book. We've also been joined by Will Bunch, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, national opinion columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer, author of After the Ivory Tower Falls, How College Broke the American Dream and Blew Up Our Politics, and How to Fix It. Dan Frumkin is editor of Press Watch. He spent over 12 years at the Washington Post. Kathy, Will, and Dan, thank you so much for your great work, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. And huge thanks to Malihe Razazan for producing today's show. Thank you so much for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Calls Media Roundtable.